teaching school, she got transferred down to Homer. He moved down there, stayed there for a number of years. He died a number of years ago, and I think she moved here and taught here for a while. But I think that was the only, I think Vonderheit was probably U.S. attorney there. Or maybe he was around some capacity, I think.
U.S. Marshal?
Oh, Marshal. I guess he, yeah, that's what he was. Yeah. That's right, he was a Marshal. Judge Kehoe was there. In fact, I went in with the, in fact, the year 1949, Judge Kehoe and his wife and my wife and I, we went on the North Wind, started at Seward on 31-day trip down the chain, what they call the floating court. Mm-hmm. We were gone 31 days and we held court, and they had the public health service people on there, the dentists, the nurses, the BIA on there. They had portable dentist chairs. We just had everything on there to take care of society, I guess, as a whole. A really interesting ship.
How big was the ship?
Big Coast Guard cutter, North Wind. Oh, we had separate rooms, my wife and I had, and Judge Kehoe, I'm sure, and we took our defense attorneys along, we took the prosecuting attorneys. I guess some people we didn't take along with jurors, we got them from there.
What was your, did you go on as assistant U.S. attorney?
I went on assistant U.S. attorney.
Why did Judge Kehoe go?
Well, Judge, as you probably know, Judge Diamond had a bad leg, and it was difficult for him to get around, and we had to climb on and off those boats to a certain extent. In many areas, because he didn't have proper docking facilities, you had to climb down on ropes and whatnot. So somebody usually went along on those trips. It was a little more ideal.
How many attorneys did they
take along? I think that's the only prosecution there was. I'm not sure. I think there's maybe a couple of private attorneys. I don't even recall who they were now. All of them didn't stay on the whole trip, but it was almost necessary to take them along. Otherwise, you couldn't accomplish too much.
Did attorneys like to go on floating boats? Was it something that people would sign up for?
Oh, yeah.
How did you get on?
Well, walk on, of course, but you mean how did you get chosen to go on?
How did you become one of
the first? Well, I that was one thing, and I guess in one sense it was kind of a bonus for maybe doing a good job rather than getting, I don't think he was trying to get rid of us, because it was a really enjoyable trip to have, and they had good food on there, and really good accommodations, and you got to see Alaska. I mean, you couldn't have taken a tour for $6,000 or $8,000 for all we got to see.
Where did you go?
Well, we started out at Seward, went to Homer, Sandpoint. If I had a map of Alaska, I could probably show you, but all those areas on the down Aleutians, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Adak, Pribilof Islands, Dillingham, Naknek, Clark's Point. We just stopped at every place. In fact, they did lots of hydrographic work and taking soundings and whatnot. They'd do that at night many times. You could hear them out there. That's taking soundings, finding out the depth of water and for navigation purposes. It was the Coast Guard, and they were getting training on that deal too, you know. And we'd go ashore in the daytime, and they might be gone for 6 or 8 hours working around the harbor there, and they'd come back and pick us up at 9.
What time of the year? What month did you go?
This was in May or June, real nice part of the year. I think it was around June, mid-May to mid-June or something like that. I'm not certain of the time. But it was 31 days, I know, and it was really, really a nice trip. And really, got to see Alaska at the time.
How many trips did they make a year?
One.
One a year.
We'd occasionally take planes and go to these other areas if emergency, but this was usually something we did once a year. Well, they usually had at least had two sides chosen up. They'd been fighting all the, well, it's not quite that, but as a practical matter, that's true. I mean, people had been cooped up there, and you usually had somebody had a big complaint. Usually we settled them by talking to the parties. You talk to one, say, get an attorney, talk to the other, and really they didn't have too many problems in those cases. One side wanted to file a complaint against the other half, another half wanted to. Well, we had much of it was naturalization. We did naturalization of those people. Either they'd gotten the papers a year before, or they'd sent in the papers and they'd processed them by mail. We'd have a swearing in ceremony, usually in the school, that's what we used. And if we had a case out there, we might select a jury, but not too many. Or we might just have a judge try a case. Most times they were on pleas, most of those places, somebody didn't get arrested unless he had done something, and he usually entered a plea. I mean, he didn't want to go to all that. He's embarrassed enough, and he didn't want to go to trial before. But usually amounted to plea, and he got sentenced there.
Were they just basically fines if people had to go to jail? Did you take them away?
We'd either put them on the Coast Guard and take them to the next airport, and ship them back in to the marshal. We had Marshall on the trip. They had a place, of course, they had a rig there in the Coast Guard that they could put them in there and they got some place to put them. Really interesting.
Carrying around with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you feel lonely being the lawyers who went on, besides the attorney, the U.S. attorney and the judge, the defense lawyers, how did they get, how was it decided who, which?
Well, more left up to the bar. If somebody actually had clients there, they were given priority, but it was more or less left up to the bar to choose who was going.
Were there any attorneys who had clients on a regular basis?
In those days, you got your liquor license issued by the court, and we always had that. We always had a hearing in those places because always the people who wanted liquor license, those who didn't. And that was a recreation for those people each year to have a liquor license hearing. In fact, the attorney used to tell me, I used to go on all those because I was younger, the attorneys there, and they used to tell me they just went over there for the trip. I mean, they go and they get them a bottle once they got over there and have a nice trip, have a hearing. It'd take 2 or 3 days, and everybody go fishing, and come back home, have a party. That's right. Ronald Kay and Bill Renfrew used to have the biggest time on those trips.
I believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So they used to go a lot, the two.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When did they stop the
clothing? Well, just wasn't too long after that. I don't recall exactly when, but it didn't. I think that was last year in which they took the Coast Guard cutter. After that, I think they did it by airlines. They did it by going in the plane. They just take a plane and kind of a charter type deal. Or we'd spend a night in one place and take a scheduled plane the next day to the other place. Oh, I think he's a, only attorney that I know that probably could try a case without preparing it and do better than most people who prepare it. I think classic case, I remember when I was assistant U.S. attorney, we were trying a case, I don't recall what it was, it wasn't too serious a case, I think it was assault case, and the morning we were supposed to start the trial, I was there and his client was there and the judge waited about 20 minutes and he just wasn't going to wait any longer. He was on the bench and Renfrew came running in and he, rather than go over to his client, he runs up to me and says, "What's my client's name and what's the charge?" So I told him, he got over there and said, "I'm sorry, Judge, that I'm late, but I'm ready to go." And we started on, went on and tried the case. Now, as I recall, he got an acquittal on the deal.
And he didn't even know anything that was about?
Well, I'm sure he must have known something about it. I mean, it just when you told him the name and something and the charge, it probably refreshed his recollection.
Wasn't
I'm sure he didn't worry about it the night before. He hadn't thought about it. But he's really a fabulous attorney.
How'd you feel being the one against him that you have?
Well, I won my share and he won his, so I think that's the beauty of the legal profession. If people take it as I perceive it is, that you win some and you lose some and you don't feel bad about it. I mean, that's if you're always right, you'd be the only one you needed, you know. Assistant U.S. Attorney in November 1947.
Who else was in the office?
Earl Cooper, Judge Cooper. He was the first judge whom I replaced when he had a stroke. And Ray Plummer was the U.S. Attorney in Cooper. And then there was a... They hired someone else just after I did. I'm trying to... McLaughlin, they hired Gerald McLaughlin, too. He was there for a number of years, even after I left.
Gerald McLaughlin?
Gerald McLaughlin. Not George, but Gerald. You'll hear about George.
Yeah.
That's not the same one. Gerald was... He was the husband of... the daughter of some lady who lived in Juneau, and he came up from Juneau and became assistant U.S. attorney. He was here for 4 or 5 years, and they moved down to California. I heard from him for a number of years, but I lost track of him in recent years.
So, Ray Plummer,
this is the political? Yes, you had to get clearance through the delegate, Bob Bartlett, in those days. He didn't know who I was. I'd never met him. And you had to clear through the Democratic National Committeeman, who was Harold Ling from Nome, and I know they ran into some problems. It held up my appointment for a couple of weeks because nobody knew me except Plummer. But nobody else was looking for the job, so I didn't have too much problem because I guess there was no other Democrat looking for the job at that time.
You didn't take the Alaska bar until 49.
That's right. No, I took it in 48, and I think it was admitted in January of 49. Yeah. Not to work with the Corps of Engineers or the U.S. Attorney. Only the bar of some state in the United States. Now, I was a member of the Alabama bar at that time, so.
Why didn't you be a member of Alaska bar?
Because I work in the federal government, and they recognize the admission to any state in the United States bar.
But that's no longer the case,
I think. Oh, I think it's true. I don't know, but I think you can still be assistant U.S. attorney or U.S. attorney without being admitted. Not likely that you will be because you get a big screen from the bar, but I think it's possible legally.
So there are only three people in the office, or four people yourself,
Ray Plummer,
Earl
Pickering,
and
the Boston? Yeah.
What was your case load like?
Fairly heavy, but I don't recall anybody was complaining too much about it. I think probably We were taking priority, and probably the people who had civil cases were complaining, but we were kept busy, but I don't recall that we had any great hue and cry of not getting criminal cases tried. In fact, I think we probably processed many more cases in those days, because particularly if it was somebody in Anchorage even, and it was other than local people as witnesses, they usually had an attorney or appointed one, and the attorney on that case said, hey, when are you going to present this to the grand jury? Because my witnesses are coming in, and I don't want to have to bring them back. Can we try it as soon as the grand jury returns to it? And we usually dispose of them within days from the time they return. I mean, it's ridiculous what we go through now compared to what we did in those days. Manslaughter, shooting somebody, assault matters, in many cases, drunkenness assaults and somebody getting seriously hurt. Occasional robbery. I recall the Travelers Inn being robbed when it was first put out there. I required prosecuting someone there. Burglaries and larcenies, murders occasionally.
Who are the people you most frequently came up against as attorney?
Well, of course, we weren't specializing in any particular thing in the U.S. Attorney's Office then. I originally came in to dispose of all the condemnation cases that had been. That's the basis on which I originally was hired, that they had a bunch of cases pending. And I started on those, but within months I was doing criminal work. And when I left, many of those cases were still there. I settled some of them, but many of those cases were still in them. So I would say I was doing about half. We were doing some Federal Torts Claim Act came into effect in about 1948. We were doing lots of those. And those were judge-tried cases, not jury-tried, and we had lots of those being tried because we had military people and they were federal. And we had, of course, we were a territory, and we had territorial criminal laws and federal criminal laws, so we were handling all federal prosecution and territorial prosecution for any federal crimes, too. Were being prosecuted, we were handling those. Not necessarily. In fact, it's only since in those days we could try them for federal crime and also try them for territorial crime without being double jeopardy.
Oh, that's good.
Huh? Well, they didn't think so in those days.
Were there any crimes that you would have a hard time getting?
Yeah, I think probably the hardest one was the stealing from the Alaska Railroad or a government agency.
Uh-huh.
And several problems in that. I remember the general manager of Alaska Railroad tried to get me fired because I wouldn't prosecute somebody for stealing Alaska Railroad property. The only thing was it also had U.S. Army stamped on it, and they'd gotten it as surplus from the Army. And there it is with the Army and Railroad stamp on it. And the guy said, I got it from the Army, and they couldn't say he didn't. They just said it was. So I finally convinced them in Washington that probably more logic to mine than was the railroad. Sure, the railroad lost something, but they didn't have very good inventory control over it either. But those cases were hard to get conviction because it's about like drunken driving today, except for the grace of God. You know, I picked up something and somebody charged me with it. And today, except for the grace of God, many people say I'll be picked up for drunken driving too. So those type of crimes are hard to convict. Really, we didn't try many cases unless we knew we were getting conviction. I don't know, maybe my perception is something. I don't very few cases we ever lost that I ever lost in criminal cases. So we wouldn't try them if we didn't have a good case. We wouldn't try them. We had lots of discretion there.
Who made the decision whether the case was a trial?
Well, in the final analysis, the U.S. Attorney did, but we made recommendation to him. I mean, it was just the facts of life. It was a hot case, and going to be lots of public sentiment. If you didn't do something, you went to the U.S. Attorney and said, "Hey, should we prosecute this whether we win, lose, or draw, just to satisfy the?" Sometime we did that, but not often. I thought Marie Plum was quite realistic. I mean, you just tell them why he wasn't going to prosecute him, and they believed him. As I recall, he was from Tennessee, I'm not sure. He was from the border states, I think. South of the border states. He was married to a school teacher, Beth Cooper, and she's still here. You might want to talk. She's very interesting. He had a real good sense of humor. He was a great actor. In fact, he loved to act. And he participated and helped form a little theater here, and he was very good at it. Very good sense of humor. Very good master of ceremonies. Nothing better than get he and Jim Vonderheit with a few drinks and get them at a party, and they'll keep replacing stitches all night.
Were there certain lawyers who were in court more than other lawyers? If you could count on
saving
court.
Oh, yeah.
Which one?
Well, if it's a civil case, you could almost count on Bill Nesbitt or Ed Davis. Criminal cases was usually Renfrew or McCutcheon. Of course, they took civil cases, too, but ordinarily McCutcheon and Nesbitt were together, and Nesbitt usually handled the criminal cases, and he handled some. So, Davis and Renfrew, Davis usually handled the civil and Renfrew the criminal. Grigsby, primarily criminal, but he handled civil too at times. Helmthal handled both. Cuddy was mostly banking and civil. He was running the bank at the time. And so he's confining his mostly to banking or civil. Not too much. He took in Wendell and he had other people. They did most of the court work, leg work. John would never handle criminal cases. He handled civil cases, primarily estates to a great extent.
Was anybody named John Dunphy?
Yeah, he's the one that was killed. You see, John was in with some time thing. He was in with Cuddy, I guess, wasn't he? Yeah, he's quite prominent. That was while I was in the legislature, I guess. He found his body on that very mysterious. They never did determine what happened to him.
John
Connolly. Yeah, John was here about that time. I don't know whether I think John came shortly after I did. Yeah, he was in with the guy that Harold Stringer and Connolly. Yeah. You know, his former wife was married to one of the oil company attorneys here, I guess. They don't live longer here now. What was her name? Betty what?
Ratterman.
Betty Ratterman. Yeah. They had two adopted children. I guess I wouldn't know them if I see them today. I knew them when they were kids.
problems with lawyers? Did people complain about lawyers in the 1940s? Stick with the 40s for asking about the Christians.
Well, I'm just speaking generally because I don't know the details. I think, as I recall, there were Windbloom had a problem. There was some problem with ethical problem on his part, and Drager, I think, was also some problem. But I don't recall the details of those in the 40s. And then we get into the 50s. I was on the ethics committee here in Anchorage, and was involved in a number of, and there were a number of. That was to handle complaints by the public of misconduct by attorneys and handling client affairs. Well, it was part of the Alaska Bar Association. They had ethics committees, I recall, in each city. And I think that's the way it was set up. Well, I can place it. The one that I'm thinking about was after that because I was on the committee and we had a case come up against one attorney who is still, in one sense, still here, still around, just lots of adverse publicity. McKay, he was one of the parties that were on our list. We were holding hearings and I was in the legislature and I disqualified myself in it because I wasn't going to be here. I don't know about the time I was Attorney General or what, but he was up before the disciplinary committee at that time. And so I know it was 450, around 57. It would have been late 50s, mid 50s.
That was before McCurry.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me try and straighten up, because that would have been in the 60s.
That was
the
court bar.
Because I was court bar fight came to head when I was at the First Judicial College in Boulder, Colorado in 1962 or 63. But I know I was embarrassed as hell when it was in the paper. They'd held up the bank or something. They had a pistol. Really embarrassing. I couldn't explain it. I didn't know. I hadn't been involved in it. Really, I didn't know too much about it. I mean, I stayed out of those. I really didn't have much explanation.
Well, I won't make you explain until you explain the 1950s. In the 1950s, before the organized bar, there were problems with Stringer and Bailey Bell and Vin Swan.
Mm-hmm.
Why were there suddenly all these things? Was it unusual that so many people were having problems with it?
Well, I'm just trying to put in perspective. As I recall, Jim Swan, I think, was probably connected to alcohol. Probably got into that. In fact, when I first went in private practice, he and Cal Moritas and I and George McLaughlin had a central area. We had one secretary. I think Marge Bell was our secretary. And we were all attorneys and using maybe her and one other secretary. I'm trying to think of her name. She's still around here. Down in the old Dykes building. And it was shortly after that, so that would have been in 50, that would have been 51 that Swan, after 51 that Swan got involved in this. And
was Bailey Bell in that same office?
No, Bailey Bell was over in the building right across from the federal building on G Street. What's that? Right in front of the Elks, I think. Somebody.
I know exactly where you're talking about.
He was in there. He and Stringer were both in that building.
So Marge Bell wasn't the secretary for father-in-law?
She was later, I think. Maybe it wasn't her over there, but I think. You see, Bailey Bell came down from Fairbanks. He was not here originally. He's from Fairbanks. He originally started in Fairbanks. He came down here. Marge and her husband were both attorneys. Or no, he was not an attorney. They were here before. They were here before Marge's father-in-law came, because I knew them and quite well. He moved down here from Fairbanks and went in with Tallman and Sanders at that time. So I think that's true. I think Marge was with her. I may be wrong, but I think she was, because. And then when she did, I think, work with him when she came down to Fairbanks.
Started which one was the first disciplinary proceeding?
I would just be guessing, but I think probably it would be, let's see, McCrary was appointed in 52. Probably it would be the Stringer. And then to Betty Bell. I think Swan would have probably been the last.
Were there any other ones?
Not that I can recall that got into, that really got to the point of getting disbarred or getting in court and being an embarrassment to someone. I think Bailey Bell's deal was somebody handcuffed him or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Stringer's was somebody who's claiming he lied or something. Or
too much money.
Too much money. Yeah, charged him. I think we had something. I think we had Herman Ross some complaints again. I don't recall. Herman Ross was here for.
Is it ROSS?
Yeah. Never will forget. He came up here and had pictures all over his wall. Senator running for senator from Tennessee. He just run to be U.S. senator from Tennessee. It spread all over his interview, and I never will forget. He had pictures of campaign pictures, and went over one day and I asked him. I think he was, there's five people in the field and he was number five, but he was really using that to his advantage up here.
Is that what they didn't like? What were the complaints?
No, it was kind of an overcharging deal too, or charging and not doing anything. I think probably he had the reputation that he could do less for you and get more money than anybody in life.
When did you take the body?
I'm just guessing. I think it was probably November, December 48, and I think it was admitted in January 49. In fact, I think I've got something here. And, yeah. So I recall it was a 3-day written exam. Then if you passed that, you had to go before the district court judge and they could ask you some questions, or some member of the bar could if they wanted to. Usually all they do is ask you your name and if you felt like you were ready to go practicing law. I'm sure Jerry Williams is the one that had prepared the bar questions. I remember I was in the U.S. Attorney's office at the time. They let the U.S. Attorney supervise my taking in my office, and I'm sure Dan Cuddy was supervised over in his office. I think there's three of us in the Cowboys. I think we all took it at the same time. Took it to different places, as I recall. I recall sitting in Ray Plummer's office and taking it. Yeah, he was there. I mean, he wasn't in the room, but I mean, he was in the office. Just using the office. That's my recollection of that time. With Dan Cuddy, Calmarides, and myself.
Was it a change in?
Well, I just decided that I was going to have to go out on my own or be with the federal government the rest of my life. Not only that, but it was a political appointment. They could fire you any time they wanted to. And I had two reasons for going out. I was got to know the personnel in one of the new banks here real well. I knew the mayor of the city real well. He wanted me to be city attorney, and they wanted me to be bank attorney at the same time, so it turned out a good time. I had a good retainer from the bank and good retainer from the city, and didn't have to give full time to either one of them. So I got together with Wendell Kay and Robinson and told them what I could, business I could bring to them, and they thought, we all thought it was a good idea, so we formed a partnership.
Who is the president of the
bank? Ben Crawford today.
Ben Crawford?
Yeah. It's now the Alaska State Bank. At that time it was Title and Trust Company, which was doing banking business. Then it became the, I'm trying to think, it wasn't Alaska, it was a federal bank at first, and I can't name it, and then we changed over to a state bank, I can't, but it was back in 40, it was organized in 49, but it got the banking power in 51, just after I became attorney for.
Who was the mayor?
Maynard Taylor. He now lives down in Arizona, next door to Bill Bittner and his wife. He had a homestead out on where Roger, I don't know whether you know where Roger Cremo, he and Roger Cremo and Ralph Cottis had adjoining homesteads out there. He was mayor, and I knew him well. He appointed me city attorney. I was city attorney. I just took it on a temporary basis, and they get someone full time. I kept it almost 4 years before they get. Well, simple reason, if you had to have someone cover them all the time, you couldn't take any vacation if you got ill. It really an advantage because they had to have legal services all the time. And if you got ill or you had to try in another case, you need someone to cover for you. One person couldn't do it.
Who covered for you usually?
Well, at the bank, Robinson usually covered for me. In the prosecution, we had, in fact, Tom Fink was in with us for a law clerk for about a year, K. Robinson Moody. He was not admitted to the bar, but he was in with us. And Wendell K. would, on many occasions, handle the city court matter or collections for the city. And that's what much of it was, collecting delinquent bills.
I forgot to ask you what Greensfield
was like in court. What was Greensfield? Well, I think the best thing I remember about him is that he was very good. Very good with the jury, very good choosing jurors, very good on examination. But he had a habit, now maybe he was hard of hearing, but I'm not sure he was. If he was hard of hearing and he wanted the jury to get something, be sure they got it, he made out like he was hard of hearing. He said, "What'd you say?" Couldn't understand. So he was a very good attorney. He knew how to handle people. He knew how to handle jurors.
He was the president of the bar, for a long time.
Ever since I can remember, until he practically retired, he was reelected him every year.
What happened at these bar meetings at the bar
when you came in? Well, not too much, really. Lots of fun. Usually we retire and have a card game. And, but I mean, there's lots that we got to know each other. I mean, we got, I think it was a much better situation you have today where people don't know anyone. You don't know whether you can trust someone. But I mean, we knew each other well enough that if you said you'd do something, you'd do it. You didn't have to have it in writing. You didn't have to make a motion. If you wanted 3 weeks to get something done, you got it. And you kept your word for it. You didn't have to go in. I think it made practice of law much easier, much more efficient. And I think probably clients got a better deal out of it for the money. Oh, I think so.
Did this kind of range help you identify them?
Certainly, certainly.
When did Gregsby stop practicing?
Well, it'd be hard for me to pinpoint it because he, well, when I first came up here, I had an arrangement with them whereby I could use his office, and he gave me a key to kind of freshen up to take the Alaska bar because I was going to eventually do it, and I had a key to his office. Well, I guess most of the time I was out at the Corps of Engineers, and I could go in there any time I wanted to. But he was, well, so I could go in there and look up Alaska law, and he wasn't around too much. Well, he liked to gamble. And I'd do some research for him sometime when he really had cases to try. I'd do research for him. But he kept really irregular office hours. He could go on drunk sometime for a week or two at a time. But he could try cases better when he's drunk than many people could when they go sober. But he really did have an alcohol problem with, but he was real good.
Oh. I interrupted you before. When did you start practicing?
Well, it's hard to tie in the year. I'm trying to. But as a practical matter, he was a number of years before he quit. He wasn't making a living. The Bar Association was subsidizing. I remember they bought him a TV and many things. They were members of the bar, either individually or something, were giving him money to take care of his house and paying his bills. But I really can't tie it into any particular year, but they paid his. No, I'm sure they paid his rent and office and whatnot the last few years, just to kind of give him some satisfaction in some places. And I'm sure he borrowed lots of money from attorneys to gamble. I know on a number of occasions I'd be in a bar and he'd come over and ask me to borrow money, and I just refused him on the basis that I wasn't doing him any favor because he drank a lot. So it was really pathetic in those when he got. What, 80s, I guess, or late 70s, or 80s?
He's still going strong in the 80s?
I really don't think from the standpoint of social close friends he had. But I think from the standpoint of professional, everybody respected his ability. Maybe he lost it in later years, but his ability and what he'd meant to Alaska. I don't know of anybody that ever went to his home or anything like that.
What had he meant? When you come into the bar, what did people tell other people about
Brady? Oh, he's the dean of the bar. And he was really in the first years, and he was a source of much information as to how to do things and what not to do in the bar. I never will forget one time when I first went into private practice, early 51, mid 51, early time I went into private practice, I walked in court one day and Jack Scavenius, remember the bar, was before Judge Dion, was telling Judge Dion he wanted to get out of a case because of some problem he's having with his client. And Judge Dion said, well, here's Mr. Moody here. I'll appoint him to be with you. I'm sure he's had lots of experience in his attorney's office. So I got stuck just because I happened to be there. And so we went over to talk to this guy. He's the one that had been accused of robbing the Traveler's Inn just after it was. And I went in and told him I'd been appointed with Jack Scavenius to represent him. I said, tell me what happened. What they got you for? He said, well, I'm not guilty. Well, just tell me what happened, what happened to the arrest. Well, it so happened that they'd had a good description of the robber and what kind of clothes he had on, how big he was, and hat and everything. And they'd found this guy hid under a car out in Mountain View with just exact clothes on and everything. And not only that, but some money from the bank and a shirt out there about 50 feet away.